I am here, the captain shouted as he staggered down the hatch. Just bring it all in, baby. Don't mess around. You know, I'm in a great mood tonight. Fantastic Monday mood. Now, I'm going to offend a lot of you tonight. There, you see, that's it. I'm going to thank you very much, dear. That's our own private Ed McMahon. Just came in and handed us a dog, you know, the can of dog food, which we will hold up and show to the people out on the West Coast. I'll tell you, I'm going to do something that's probably going to offend a lot of you tonight. Tonight is a yay-saying show. I mean, you don't mind if, you know, of course, in this day of the universal put-down, the universal life is a drag time that we're all living in. They're all plotting against me. What is there to live for time, you know? It's just terrible to have to come out and take another side to the issue. Now, there's a lot of good things about life. I mean, really, there are a lot of unbelievably groovy things about life. Do you agree with that, Herb? Come on now. There he goes, typical engineer. His glasses are clouding up with anger. And as far as he's concerned, the only good thing about life is the coffee break, which is written into the union contract. And them finks wouldn't have given it to him if they hadn't written it in anyway. So nevertheless, I'm going to tell you that Now, what are some of the great things about life? No, I'm not going to belabor you with the obvious. We know what some of those good things are. But I'm going to do a pro-New York show tonight. Now, that is really off the wall, isn't it? New York has been getting bad-mouthed so long, and, you know, every place you go, you go out to some place like Chillicothe or Rabbit Hash, Kentucky, or someplace like that, see, and you're not there 5 minutes, and some red-faced native says this to you. Well, I was in New York once. You remember that time, May, when we went out there to that World's Fair they had out there? Well, we went out there that time. I'll tell you, New York's a... I'd say it's a good place to visit, but I just don't know how you people stand living there. Well, I'm going to offend a lot of you who secretly believe, you know, that we here in New York really have a bad time. Yeah, and I'll tell you one of the reasons why a lot of us pretend that it is bad. It's to keep you out. You see, we figure if we badmouth loud enough, you know, we'll cut off the supply of immigrants that are pouring in over the George Washington Bridge hourly. You see, if we can convince them that where they should stay in is Potboiler, Maine, that we would, you know, one less klutz on Sixth Avenue is one less klutz. But nevertheless, there are some great things about New York. And I'm going to tell you one of them. Well, who was it who came up with that great line that said, any place out of New York is camping out? That was a great line. I don't know who it was. It sounds like Fred Allen, you know. Anytime you're out of New York, you're camping out. And there's some truth to that. And any guy who's lived in New York any length of time feels, whenever he's outside of town, that he's off stage. That he's been pushed into the scenery. And that back home is where, you know, all, it's really happening. And you get so that you look for items in the paper, you know, Dateline New York. And you feel a sense of pride. You know, it says, New York, a 27-car accident on the Long Island Expressway today claimed 228 people, the biggest accident ever in the history. And you say, what a great time. You just feel a sense of a kind of loss, a sense of nostalgia. You do. I'm serious. And it gets to the point where no matter where you are, you hunger for, you know, the sounds of New York. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this. I'm going to be deluged with angry letters, you know, from people living in places like PPAC. You don't know how great it is to live in PPAC. Yes, I do, friend. You know how wonderful it is. We have such a wonderful little league team up here in Darien. You think? Why, we have... Come on, I know about that. He who protesteth is protesting. I mean, try to convince me about, you know, how rich and full life is in Westport. It's going to not be very easy, because I see those worried, hungry looks of guys, darting for the 522 to get out to beautiful Westport, you know, sit there amid your martini swizzlers and, wait for Armageddon or whatever it is you're waiting for. But there's something else about New York that I'll have to explain to you. Why I have this feeling tonight of euphoria. I did a New York... Let's put it this way. I just experienced a very private New York religious moment. Now, what is a New York religious moment? Well, let's put it this way. There is nothing in the world. Now, I have traveled pretty much in the world. You concede that, you know. I have traveled pretty much. And I say this to you as a traveler. There is nothing in the world like a New York deli in full flower. I'm serious. And there's nothing can suffice once you have tasted at the Empyrean Springs, once you have sipped the rarefied elixir of Dr. Brown's celery tonic, once you have walked into that paradise, that vast that Xanadu of the 7th Avenue Deli, with the great rising aroma of the lotus exhalation of pastrami. Oh, great turgid currents of nameless passions swirl through your innermost marrow of your bones. Oh my God, pastrami. Hebrew national salami.
All I want, it's all over. Every place. Onion rolls, give me the onion rolls. Quick, the horseradish.
Slowly, with a sense of relief and a sense of being home, you settle down as your waiter pours the soup, the celery soup, on the back of your neck, and he slams that pastrami down in front of you, and you dig into that New York rye bread, chomping steadily. With a little coleslaw on the side. Be there a klutz with soul so dead, who never to himself has said in the dark of night, my God, what I would do for a little pastrami right now. Ah, little whitefish on rye with a slice of Bermuda onion. Just a little touch of tomato. Now, you think I'm kidding, and a lot of you who are living outside of New York don't know exactly what I'm talking about. But it is true, and I'll tell you, some of my more itchy moments have been spent on a world trip. See, I'm going out of New York about 3 months or 8 weeks or something, and you begin to sense something. Like one day, I'm in the Canary Islands, and I'm walking along through this narrow, twisting street, and I'm with another guy from New York. See, we're looking at this town. It's great, and we're doing the things you do, and there's the long curving sea coast and the mountains in the background. We're having a little sangria or something, you know. We're playing it big for each other. Isn't this great? Yeah, it sure is great. A lot more sangria here. Sure is great, I'll tell you. Well, 20 minutes later, we are now on the fantail of the QE2, the two of us. And we're heading out to sea. Now, you know what the QE2 is. This is as British as you can get. And we are being served what look like tin-encrusted crumpets with a little cup of kind of tepid tea with what appeared to be either, I couldn't tell whether it was a dead weevil or whether it was a dead fly that was floating or a piece of rice. I don't know. And we're floating along there, see? Looking out over the sunset, drifting out to sea. When all of a sudden I had to say it, I said, Reggie? He said, yeah. You know what I'd like right now? He said, what? I said, I don't want to offend anybody. I'd like about, I'd say about a half pound of 7th Avenue chicken liver. I would like it laved nice and rich and thick and ripe right here on this, a piece of thin white bread. That's the way you eat chicken liver, you know, just a little salt and a little pepper, and eat it the way nature intended it to be eaten. Just like that. And he looked at me, his face got white. He said, I wish you hadn't mentioned that. I said, why? He says, God, I couldn't sleep all night thinking of some soft salami. Well, you can't escape it. Once you have tasted, believe me, once a lotus eater has tasted the bud, he cannot go back to dandelions. There's no way. And speaking of essentially, in fact, quintessentially, New York, this is WOR. And I'll point out to this to you, friend. You may not even appreciate this. Perhaps you're not well-traveled enough, or who knows, you know, maybe your education was sadly neglected when you're at the age of 28. But nowhere in the world is there a radio station like WOR. You know that? It is genuinely New York. All over the country, there are rock stations that sound exactly like every rock station in town. All over the country, there are guys with telephone shows. And, yes? Well, the trouble with the Atlanta Braves, of course, can be very easily solved. The other day, I was talking to Bertie Tebbets, and in other words, the universal expert abounds on the telephone all across the country. There are classical musical stations across the country. But there's only one station in the country that is so New York, it makes your teeth squeak. I mean, really. This is it. You're right here, friends. There ain't no other. This is it. And if you think, you know, it's rock or something, no, forget it. They're playing rock in Phoenix, the same rock. They're playing the same rock in Tijuana. They're playing the same rock in Portland, Maine. But only one station has Martha Dean. Good morning. This is Martha Dean. This is it. You got that? And Al McCann saying,
Dora, I was talking to the wonderful folks from the New Jersey Egg Council, and they had, their annual striped bass breakfast, and this is so, so New York, you know. And so I went tonight, I went out, you know, and I'm drifting along Broadway, and I went into one of my favorite haunts, the Stage. The formative years of my life, I must tell you, were spent in the Stage. And I mean, they really did form me. And I remember long, late nights in the Uptown Stage, you know, the one up on, the one Uptown, you know, Max. I'm standing up there one day, waiting in line for my Whitefish, and I'm with an old buddy of mine who was at that time struggling. Man, he was, you know, he was really struggling. Not that he isn't now. Me and Milt Kamen. And Milt and I are waiting. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, see, and all the boys are yelling and hollering at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. All the shows are out, and all the comics from every show is in town. And at that time, I was rehearsing New Faces. And, man, that was rough business. And it's 4 in the morning, and I'm feeling hungry and mad. And I'm standing there with my buddy, see, at the Milt. And I said to Milt, I looked out over the scene of unrivaled of gustatory delights, this scene of unrivaled passion, this scene of soul New York. It was home. In fact, there's a lot of guys feel a lot more at home, believe me, in the Stage or the 7th Avenue Deli or the Carnegie, who feel more at home there than they do in their home. Now, it's hard to explain why. You have to be a certain type. I suppose I'm this way. I must honestly feel that I feel more at home with the Damon Runyon world than I do with the world most people seem to associate me with. Believe me, I do not go back to Hammond, Indiana, hang around and talk to Flick. That's the last thing in this world I'd want to do. So, you know, and so I'm standing in line, and I remember looking out over the scene, see, and I can hardly wait, and I can see these, you know, these seated rolls, out there in front of me, and I could smell the onion rolls. And for those of you who do not know what a New York onion roll is, I can only say that if you think you've tasted all the things in this life, friend, an onion roll at Ratner's at 2 o'clock in the morning with little scrambled eggs and chopped onions in it, it transcends any high that most people are ever going to, you know, hit in their life. It's all part of the whole thing. You got to know about it. So I'm standing in line there, and I said to Milt, it just hit me. I said, Milt, he said, yeah. You know, Milt is real nervous. I said, Milt, see, he is, Milt Kamen is what Woody Allen plays. See, Woody Allen plays nervous, but Woody's on top of it. Believe me, Woody's more on top of it than any guy you ever met. He's a tiger. I mean, he really, but Milt is really that guy, see? Milt is really nervous. Girls are always giving him bad looks, you know, and for weeks he'll go in hiding. Because some girl at the Woolworth, you know, in the perfume counter, gave him a bad look when he was walking through, and he said, did you hit the girl? What did I do? This is Milt, see? So, and me and Milt, you know, we're old friends, and so you got to handle Milt that way, you know, kid gloves. So we're standing in line there. I don't, you never hear this side of Shepherd's life, do you? So we're standing, you know, the professional comic side. So we're standing, oh, yeah, let me tell you about the time one night Mel Brooks and I went for 2.5 hours trading ad-libs in the turf. And, listen, I there's hardly a day goes by, but what I don't feel is a sense of deep sorrow that they closed the doors of the turf. There's a lot of guys, it's like, you know, your own home has been turned off. At 3 a.m, I used to go down there with Herb Gardner, you know, who wrote 1,000 Clowns. And we would go down there, and I introduced him to clams. And at 3 a.m, we would go down and get all clammed up at the turf clam bar and top it off with a little, you know, cherry cheesecake and wash it down with a little celery tonic and walk for blocks just burping. And, it's a great feeling. You didn't know you were going to run into this tonight. Well, anyway, I'm talking to Milt. See, and I says, hey, Milt. And he says, yeah. I said, Milt, you know, do you ever call up, you know, your mother, your father, somebody, you know, somebody from your family back in Brooklyn, wherever it is you come from, and call them up and say, hey, this is Milt. I made it. I'm big time now, Dad. He says, well, yeah, he said, I tried it, but it don't impress him. I says, well, Milt, you know what you got to do? And he says, what? I says, Milt, you know, sometime you call your old man, you say to him, hey, Dad, this is Milt. Yeah? What do you want? Well, Milt, this is Milt. And Dad, listen, I just got elected the Citizen of the Month. I mean, a Citizen of the Month, and they gave me a plaque at the White House. And what does your old man say? Huh? So, can you eat a plaque? What do you say then? Well, Dad, I've just been, you know, I'm up for an Academy Award. Oh, award? What's award? Well, what are you going to do? Can you live on a little statue? What is it? A little statue they give you, huh? Nope. What you got to do is call them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, Dad, I made it. Say, oh, what? You made it? What? How? Dad, the stage has named a sandwich after me. They got a Milt Kamen. Right there with Fred Allen. Right there with Bob Hope. The Danny Kaye Goose Liver Special. Now they got the Milt Kamen. The Milt Kamen. I says, your old man would understand that. He says, oh, God, what I do? I'd give anything if they had a Milt Kamen in the 7th Avenue Valley. Oh, man, I'll tell you, I must admit, do you know that there was once, at one time, in New York City, I wonder how many of you remember it, was one of the great moments in my whole life. You know that there was a restaurant in this town, right in the middle of New York City, right, in fact, right off Times Square, that had a Gene Shepherd sandwich. The Gene Shepherd, did you know that? And I used to go in there and I'd eat it, seeing it was just great. It's great to walk in and say, yeah, I'll have one of my specials. And the guy says, what do you want? You want a Sammy Kaye? What do you want? What special you want? The Danny Kaye? You want the Jack Benny? I says, no, I'll have one of my specials. I am Gene Shepherd. Hey, Manny, there's a real Gene Shepherd. Here he is. And the next thing you know, they bring you this giant sandwich, you know, with all, where was it?
What was the sandwich? Are you curious what it was? Oh, what a sandwich. I want to tell you, whoever it was knew what I like. There's nothing I like better than whitefish. It was a whitefish sandwich, cold. A cold whitefish sandwich with very thin white bread and a slice of thin, thin, very fresh Bermuda onion with salt and pepper and with a touch, just a touch, of horseradish. That is a sandwich that could cause, that could easily be, that's the missionary's downfall of sandwiches. And I want to tell you, what restaurant was it? I bet you don't know. Did you ever see Rossoff's? R-O-S-O-F-F-S? Rossoff's had a Gene Shepherd special. And it was great. Where are they? They're over here on the, in the 40s, right off of Times Square. Well, I want to tell you, there's nothing like that hunger for your native heath that hits you at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning in various countries. Now, I don't care how hip you are. In fact, anybody who claims that he has not felt these pangs somewhere is not a real traveler. One of the best descriptions I ever read about this feeling was a description that S.J. Perelman one time wrote. And by the way, Perelman is one of my favorite human beings. And yes, one of the very first calls that I ever got when I first started in New York was a call from Perelman, who called one night from Bucks County, the listener type. And we had a lot of things afterwards. But one night, I was sitting all by myself reading Perelman. And there was a passage in one of his stories, which I forget now. It was when he was making a round-the-world trip with Harry Hirschfeld, And he was talking about running out of his hotel one night in Bangkok. He was about to flip. He had a total, unbelievable, all-consuming hunger for a Hershey bar. I mean, what is more American than a Hershey bar with almonds? And he ran up and down the streets for hours, and there were all kinds of little guys sitting there ringing bells and hitting things together, And he said he lay in his bed that night with sweat, it's very hot in Bangkok, dreaming of Hershey bars, and dreaming of walking into any A&P, and just buying Hershey bars and dribbling them down over his head, just like a miser. Well, now this happens to you. And a friend of mine out on the West Coast, who's one of my old friends here in New York, an artist, and he constantly writes me from the coast, and he says, the coast has got a lot of stuff going for it. He says, but no matter where you slice it, no matter where you go, there ain't no Carnegie Deli. He says, now they got their imitations out here, but there's something vaguely missing. So I don't know what it is. And he says, in the 2 and 3 in the morning, sometimes he says, I wake up with the smell of the beautiful Pacific Ocean, everything going on out there. And he says, and I imagine going into the 7th Avenue, the 6th Avenue Deli is another groovy one. He says, I imagine going into Katz's. Oh, let me tell you, friends, don't get me started on Ratner's. I grew up in Ratner's. I attained my adult maturity in Ratner's. But that's another story. And he sent me this piece, which I want to read to you, out of a West Coast newspaper. And it doesn't even have a... Oh, yes, it's a guy by the name of Bert Prelutsky writes this piece called West View. Now, listen carefully, and you'll know what I mean. It's called Tokyo Knish. And it says, Tokyo is a marvelous city. It has fine restaurants, beautiful parks, and a delirious nightlife. Although 14 million people call it home and office, you are rarely aware of their number. By American standards, even their traffic seems relatively uncongested. Drop another 6 million bodies in New York City, and the only thing that would flow would be blood. Still, that's true. By any standards, the town came within a hair of being a total washout. Make that a herring. For what, I ask you, is a city without a delicatessen? What is it? It is a house without a roof, a ship without a sail, a clarinet without a reed, a body without a heart, and more than that, it is a heart without heartburn.
He says, as far as I'm concerned, if I can't find a good kosher-style deli in heaven, I'm going to pack my bags and just split. Fortunately, I'm not the only person who feels that way, even in Tokyo. And so I found myself the other day, and I'm quoting this writer, at 9625 Akasaka Minotaku, just up the block from the Mitsubishi Bank, having a pastrami on rye and savoring the sort of authentic sour pickle that cures colds, discourages frostbite, and wards off werewolves and evil curses. For over 2 weeks, I had thought of nothing but deli. Listen to this. For over 2 weeks, I had thought of nothing but deli. Every car that drove past on white wall tires reminded me of so many bagels smeared with cream cheese. Every shrine I looked out looked like a salami. Every pagoda looked like a pumpernickel. At sunset, the lakes all looked like cold borscht. At sunrise, they resembled egg creams. Even sleep brought no relief. In my dreams, I chased pastramis down strange, dark streets. Little toasted bagels rolled by, always out of reach. In my sleep, I murmured a litany. Cantus, Greenblatt's, Nathan Ells, the bagel. Oh, yeah, the bagel. The stage. The mash box. Oh, my God. When my wife would wake me from my nightmare, I'd be drenched in sweat. And she'd offer me a glass of water. Water! She'd offer me a glass of water. Water, I'd scream. Don't torment me. When a man's thirsty, he wants water. But I'm dying. When a man is dying, he wants cream soda. Cream soda. Yeah. In a city this size, it would have been easy to overlook Ann Dinkin's little delicatessen. But I'd rather not think about it. Mrs. Dinkin, who was 65 years old, equal parts Mrs. Goldberg and Auntie Mame. She speaks pure Bronx and wears Pucci stockings. She came to Japan 20 years ago with her husband. She was a milliner. He was in the import-export business. She divorced him 8 years ago after, quote, he went south with a geisha girl. She brags, quote, my Japanese lawyer told me to wear a long demure dress and long white gloves to court. I told him, honey, forget it. I wear a short dress and a gallon of perfume. I wanted those judges to smell me clear across the room. And honey, I bet I'm the only dame who ever got money out of a Japanese divorce court. Although her ex-husband lives only 5 blocks away, she never sees him. She laughs in pure Phyllis Diller tones. Ha! How that man must be dying for a corned beef sandwich. Her place is tiny. Only 20 noshers can be seated at any one time. But the joint boasts a cosmopolitan clientele. Danny Kay, Rick Jason, Joe DiMaggio, Johnny Cash, Shirley MacLaine drop in when they're in town. It was, in fact, Shirley's husband who taught Mrs. Dinkin to make potato pancakes. I say that word, I mean that phrase, you know, with a note of humility. Potato pancakes, you know, with a little touch of onion? Just right, see? She says, I was married 25 years. I never went in the kitchen, but when you have to, you cook. I wondered how the Japanese had reacted to deli. Are you curious? She says, if they didn't like the merchandise, I'd be out of business. Half of my customers are Japanese. They especially love chicken soup. Well, you know, why not? Have you ever had good deli chicken soup? You know, one of the great things... Oh, we've gone and on. She says, I even send salami plates to the neighborhood geisha houses. I used to make hats for the royal family. Now, the princesses call up for my cheesecake, and the emperor phones for my gefilte fish. He is crazy about our horseradish. Not only that, she stores her sour pickles in the basement of the local Jesuit rest and recuperation center. On her wall hangs an honorary degree she recently received from the local Catholic university. It reads, Sophia University salutes Ann Dinkin, a great and noble lady. That is true. And that she says all of her food comes from Hebrew National, by the way, of New York. It's the real stuff. A ton and a half at a time. When I asked her if she had any plans to expand, she shook her head. No, this is it. So I got my place, my little deli, and that's all I want. And now she's... There it is. So You know, this is something you have to explain. It's very difficult to explain to people. For example, when you're traveling, really cut off from your own roots and stuff, you begin to think of things. You begin to taste things in your own deep inner taster that you never really tasted before, that you totally accepted for what it was. And I never forget the first time I came, one of the very first times I came into New York. I was in the Army. And, I say this about delis. Delhi is not ethnic, if you think it is. Delhi is pure New York. Now, I suspect ultimately the New Yorker himself, I mean just a New Yorker, is an ethnic group in itself. I mean, you know what I mean? That the New Yorkers have fought the same battles. I mean, being a New Yorker is a very special phenomenon in today's world. And being a New Yorker transcends all nationalities. So I don't think that the nationalities split you as much from the rest of the people in the country as the phenomenon of being a New Yorker. And so I remember one night, you get into memories. Almost anybody who talks about delis has all kinds of deli stories. I mean, deli stories are as common in New York as, in other places. The big fish I caught one time on the opening day of the season. deli stories are, and of course, the people who work in delis are a special crew. It's almost a priesthood. That a waiter at the stage is like no other waiter in the world. Do you concede that? And you can see them sometimes in other places. Like there's a deli in Fort Lauderdale, and it is packed, staffed completely by the same bronze looking guys that you can see any day over at the Carnegie, giving you another plate of pickles. And I remember that one of the first times I came into New York. I mean, if you're curious about when you first hit your home. Now, home is a strange thing. It's hard to tell where home is with people. You know, many people can grow up in a place and it's not their home. What is a home? Is a home where you grow, or is a home where you live? I mean, where you come into being? Where is a home? It's hard to say. You know, a lot, and it works in reverse many times. Like somebody can grow all of his life in New York and never be a New Yorker. Never. In fact, I know one guy, it doesn't matter, one guy who is a famous writer about New York. He writes a great deal about this city. And he's not really a New Yorker. And that is, let us put it this way, he's not a Manhattanite. He is a Brooklynite. And there's a world of difference. That living in Manhattan is a different, just a whole different mystique. And if you grew up, say, down on, you don't have to necessarily come from any area, but some of the areas I know best, say, for example, down around 2nd Avenue, down around 8th Street and 7th Street, 10th Street, and so on. That is as different from growing up in Brooklyn as, say, growing up in Ogden, Utah is growing up in Tokyo. I mean, they're all two different things. And so when I first came to New York, I'll never forget this time I walked the first night. The word deli, there used to be a cartoon strip that never made sense to me. And I used to read it when I was a kid. Do any of you remember a cartoon strip that was about a guy who had a delicatessen? I believe it was called Pete's Delicatessen. Did anybody ever see that strip, or did I invent it? No, I know I didn't invent it. It actually existed. And does anybody else remember Pete's Delicatessen? Well, that was a cartoon strip that was about the delicatessen. And it was Pete's Delicatessen. And I used to, as a kid, I would read this, and to somebody living in Chicago, or somebody living in Indiana or Utah, or somebody living even in Maine, delicatessen usually means a little store, a little store where you go in and you buy canned goods or something. You go out. A delicatessen means a little neighborhood store. But a delicatessen in New York does not mean that. Oh, not at all. And I mean, there's nothing like going into a deli in New York and saying, hey, I'll have a cream cheese on a seeded roll, And that's the goal, of course. And I'll have a sliced turkey with some Russian, and put that on rye. And yeah, I'll have them both to go, and give me a couple of egg creams to go. And that is unknown in most parts of the country. Now, what was that called? Did somebody want to know about Pete's Deli? Please, who did Pete's Delicatessen? Was there a cartoon strip? I would like to hear somebody who also read that strip. And it seemed to me he did some other strip. He was a famous cartoonist. But, no, you take it. That I was reading this thing for years. It made no sense to me. I mean, it was a funny strip, and I thought it was funny, like a kid will think a cartoon is funny. But I always related it to Mattingly's store down at the street. And they never made sandwiches in Mattingly's store. You know, you couldn't go in and ask for a sandwich and say, make me a ham on rye with a seeded roll or something like that on the side. You couldn't go in and buy a sliced turkey sandwich in a local store. But that cartoon strip was about that. People were always coming in and buying sandwiches and stuff, and the whole thing was about the deli. Well, that cartoon strip sort of settled down in my mind among things that I laughed at. Among other things, I'm probably the only living fan of Smokey Stover. You remember Smokey Stover? Notary Sojak? And I used to love Smokey Stover. And another one, J.R. the Spotted Wonder Dog, which was all part of that same world. And I never followed cartoon strips. To me, cartoon strips like Smiling Jack meant nothing. I never read them. I never even followed Dick Tracy. And I never read Little Orphan Annie. But I was always reading stuff called, Smokey Stover. Another one I always read was the one with the little hitchhiker in it. You remember the one with the little hitchhiker? And the hitchhiker always had this coal scuttle on the top of his head. Yeah, you couldn't see his face. He was always just hitchhiking, see? And once in a while, he would say, "Nav Schmaz Kapap." That's all he ever said. And one day in the strip, one character said to the other, "How come he's always wearing a coal scuttle on his head?" He said, "Well, didn't you hear about it?" And the other one says, "No, what?" He said, "Well, he's afraid of, Dave's Delic, of course, please, give me a little of Dave's, yes, Dave's Delicatessen. Hooray for Dave!" Somebody just called in. I'm wrong. It was not Pete's. It was Dave's Delicatessen called in. Listen to this. A listener just called. He once flew from Nairobi to Tokyo. It took him 27 hours just for deli. He found it. He says he went to that place I just mentioned. He went to Ann's place, Ann Dinkel's joint. He went down there and sat and noshed until, you know, he just fell over sideways and made squeaking sounds. And yes, you won't find a deli in Nairobi, I'll tell you that. But nevertheless, there's a story. Now, there's a fellow traveler who can tell you that the same hunger, the same... Now, a lot of you are listening to this, and you're thinking I'm romanticizing this. Not so. It's not a romantic concept. It is a real thing that happens to people when they're cut off from their roots, really cut off, and you begin to appreciate it. Now, I've been cut off several times. And, you know, this really, really changed me. But Dave's Delicatessen always seemed a curious cartoon to me. Because the word deli does not, I repeat, not have the same connotation across the country. In fact, I wonder how many things come out of New York that we just accept for granted here in New York, and we laugh at or we don't laugh at, that are totally without meaning in the rest of the country. For example, you'll watch a talk show and somebody will say, "Oh boy, now that's what I call chutzpah." I just wonder what ladies in Iowa wonder what chutzpah is. What is this? Yeah. Or somebody will say, "Oh, you know, nothing like a, you know, just walk in and have yourself a knish and maybe, you know, what does this mean to a lot of people around the country?" Nothing. The phrases which we use, like borscht circuit, I wonder how many people even know what it means. But the word deli does not mean the same in New York as it does, say, in Hammond, Indiana. And so the second night I was in New York, I was staying at the Hotel New Yorker, and I was with Gasser. And there I am, you know, I'm PFC, and I'm really on my uppers. No money at all. I had about 12 cents and my bus ticket back to Fort Monmouth. And so we went over to the USO, which was at that time located, you know where the Castro joint is here on Times Square? Well, it wasn't a USO, it was a Pepsi-Cola canteen, as a matter of fact. And so we went into the Pepsi canteen there, and you know, we were figuring we'd get a sandwich and maybe some Pepsi, they give you away free. So we walk in, had no money at all. So we went up to the lady at the desk, and we says, "You got any tickets for any show?" She says, "Well, we've got some tickets here for some free meals and stuff. You guys want to go out and have a nice dinner before you go out and go to a show?" She says, "We got a couple of tickets for the hockey game." And so, "Oh, very groovy. We'll go to the hockey game." And so she says, here, take this ticket, and you show it, give it to the man at the counter at the 7th Avenue Deli, and they'll give you a meal there. I thought, the deli? What is this? You know, what are they going to give you, a can of beans or something? So we went down the street to the 7th Avenue Deli. I gave him the tickets, and all these people are sitting around, seeing they're chomping away at the egg rolls and stuff. And I says, "Here." And a minute and a half later, I was initiated. And there's no going back. No going back. I sat there in front of a Fred Allen special that weighed 7 pounds. This baby came in a shoulder holster. It was dripping Russian dressing all over my Eisenhower jacket. And the tomatoes, and the fry, the beautiful frizzled pastrami around the edges, this little skillet, it's a taste that no other sandwich in the world quite touches. A Fred Allen special at the 7th Avenue Deli. Thank you very much. Gee, you play that instrument well, I'll tell you. So I told you I was going to offend you tonight. I mean, you know, after all, there are a lot of great things about life. We better remember them. I saw a little essay the other night on the egg cream on TV. Well, there are two schools of egg cream fanciers. I happen to belong to the, let's say, the reformed egg cream fancier. I have a particular predilection for coffee egg cream made, well, of course, there you go again. You know, you get into these ideological arguments, there's just no end, no place to go. So, happy pretzel to you, friend. Hang loose, and burp good.